The opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
I'm D. Watkins, here with Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today, I'll be joined by my brilliant co-host, Dr. Marsha Chatlin. Marsha is also Associate Professor of History and African-American Studies at Georgetown University. In studio, we have Major Neil Franklin, who's a 34-year law enforcement veteran of the Maryland State Police and Baltimore Police Department. We also have Sandra Thompson, a college professor in law and director of the Criminal Justice Institute at the University of Houston Law Center. How you guys doing today?
Wonderful.
Good.
Great, great, great. So we have a lot of things to talk about, and I'm so happy, you know, we have so many different people from so many different types of backgrounds joining this conversation today, because the people want answers. I think it'd be right to start with Mr. Franklin. Hopefully you've been listening to the podcast, and, you know, I feel like it's been kind of one-sided because we haven't had a lot of people who actually had to work as a police officer to give us some insight or help us learn about some of the things that we may have been missing. You know, I've never worn a badge for anything except for maybe like when I was trying to be like a safety.
It's probably more dangerous than being a police officer.
Being a safety in elementary school doesn't come with any privilege, like, other than ridicule from other students. So what are some of the things you think we might miss when we have these conversations as civilians who are trying to critique how law enforcement actually works in a place like Baltimore City?
There's been recently a lot of talk about police reform. It's been a lot of effort to change some of our laws, not just here in Maryland, for how police operate, but across the nation. Police officers' Bill of Rights, for one thing, has been challenged, and they continue to do work on that. One area I think that we really miss when we talk about police reform is the policies, the basic policies in which we go about our business of policing, from the war on drugs to how we send police into schools to deal with our young people in some cases. And we see this changing, but still hasn't changed enough. I mean, when you look at Freddie Gray's case, and I want to try to keep it close to that particular circumstance of dealing with Freddie Gray. You know, here's a young man who, from what I understand, was dealing with some mental health challenges, dealing with lead paint poisoning. When you look at his arrest history, it's primarily centered in this place of so-called drug crime violations and so on. And, you know, we hear over and over again that this issue of the war on drugs, it's not a war on drugs, it's a war on people. I think it's clear, the data points to that. When you look at the numbers of people who are being arrested and charged, who go to jail, how long they spend time in jail, and so on, it's black folks. And, of course, we all know that across this country, different demographics, white, black, Latino, other, we all use and sell drugs at relatively the same rates. But the ones who spend the most time in prison and go to prison and who are arrested by the police are black folks. So here we have our police enforcing these policies that don't work, and people like Freddie Gray get caught in the middle of it. And it creates a very aggressive style of policing within our police departments. And when you look at the arrests that, you know, Lieutenant Rice and Nero and these guys were Miller making, most of these arrests, I mean, this is just a snapshot, most of these arrests are for these drug crime violations, and unfortunately that's how we're evaluating our police.
So, but this whole question of reform is when police officers say they're just doing their job, it's just a reflection of what their bosses are telling them to do. It's not a culture, or it is a culture?
Well, it's both. It's all the above. It is what their bosses are telling them to do. Unfortunately, the matrix that we've been using to evaluate our police over the decades is numbers driven. It still is. Even though we know that this is very problematic, we still haven't made the correct adjustments that we need to make in evaluating our police officers. So, how many arrests did you make last week? How many arrests did you make last month? I'm pulling you on the carpet because you haven't been out there making arrests. And, you know, the police officers know this is how I get the better assignment. This is how I get promoted, so I'm going to go out here and make the arrest. And despite whatever discipline you're in, you all want to do better. You all want to go up. You want to get promoted. You want to get better assignments. You want to make more money. And that then moves into this culture and how we go about policing, and we get to a place where we don't even see people like Freddie Gray as people.
So, Marsha, feel free to jump in anytime. But Sandra, you write about all of these topics: jury discrimination, police interrogation, federal sentencing. What does reform look like? Can you give us an understanding of what it can actually look like if it was something that could be a real thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, dovetailing with what was just said, that we have to, you know, think about the incentives that are in place for promotion and the like. And, you know, another area where we see the same kinds of problems has to do with the use of civil asset forfeiture, which, you know, also has this, you know, creates this incentive for more drug arrest, drug interdiction, and the like. And there are lots of these kinds of incentives. And, you know, I think the police need to go back and really think about their priorities and change their policies. I mean, here in Houston recently, the DA said, we're not going to accept any charges for low-level marijuana possessions. And so, you know, that's just going to take thousands of these arrests off the table. And we need to start moving in that direction and using those really precious police resources for the crimes people really care about. And so, you know, I think that it starts with an overall assessment of the priorities of departments and the kinds of arrests that are being allowed.
Marsha?
Yeah, I think that this question of reform is, on its surface, it can seem like easy, like, oh, body cameras, or, oh, you know, disincentivize stops or stop the war on drugs. But I think that after we peel back this layer of asking for reforms, there is a fundamental question we have in our society, back to an earlier point about the value and worth of people, right? And so I think in many ways we can, I think what's hard is that the easy way out is the policy reforms, but the kind of fundamental question of how we restructure society, that's like for the other to-do list. So I think that we have to really think about how we hold people who have breached whatever kind of trust we expect them to have, how we hold them accountable, and how we make sure that people aren't paying for it for the rest of their lives. And I think that what I really love about this episode is the parts that talk about not just kind of the officers involved, but the context in which Freddie lived, that he had so many run-ins with law enforcement. And all of these really difficult choices individuals have to make in courtrooms. When do you take the plea, or do you, you know, take a chance with a trial? Like, what does it mean when you have a prior conviction, how it fundamentally shapes the rest of your life? And, you know, for me, it was really important to look into the dynamics of what does it mean to be a black police officer. Not to say that if a person is black and they're a police officer, they shouldn't be held accountable, but this kind of dual role that black police officers have played in BPD and other systems, where on one hand, they're doing the work of the police, but on the other hand, they're fighting against the culture of the police with, you know, varying results. And so I think that, you know, for listeners who really are interested in the dimensions of the complexity of this problem, why body cameras don't solve all our problems, why having a black police commissioner doesn't solve all our problems, I really hope that they see that, you know, this really comes down to some fundamental issues that can be the most challenging for us to take up as a society.
Do we expect black police officers to be more responsible for protecting citizens in African-American communities? Is that like a thing? Because from my experiences, the experiences I've had with black police officers, it seemed like they were trying to assimilate and fit in with the people they work with more than they were trying to be standalone revolutionary. I'm going to here to protect, like Action Jackson. Like, I know. Yeah, I feel like, let's use Action Jackson. Let's use Action Jackson as a case study.
Yeah, Action Jackson. Wow. You are coming through with the dated references. I think that, you know.
I actually don't even know what it's about. I just know it's like Apollo Creed as a cop. I don't even know what the film was about or anything. I might have blew that one.
Well, I mean, okay. So when we think about black police officers specifically, right, we have this long history where, you know, black people were not allowed to, you know, serve in the military on an equal basis. And we have this long history of black people, even when they are in police departments like BPD, you know, they don't have patrol cars, they're not armed, they're not allowed to, you know, patrol white neighborhoods. So, you know, there's this long history of struggle. And the question is, What were the mechanisms that Black police officers used to get equality in the police force? And how has this created problems for Black communities rather than solve some problems? And so I think when we look at the Vanguard Justice Society and BPD, what we see is, on one hand, a really strong civil rights sensibility about protecting the possibility for advancement in the police ranks, but no critical reform of how policing is done. And so I think that that's why when Black police officers are in situations like what happened to Freddie Gray and in other, you know, police jurisdictions like Chicago or Los Angeles, where you see Black officers abusing Black citizens, it really starts to kind of give, I think, a lot of unease about what does it mean to fight so hard for equality in a system that can ultimately harm so many Black people. From the Andy Jones era, when homicides was high, every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West, I be getting money, but it's different on my side. Lord, it's 14 already trying to ride. Even when they go to school, they got the pistol by their side. Lord, how is gonna be ready when the enemy collides? Listeners of Undisclosed, I have a confession. I am a glutton for wonderful, luxurious bath and beauty products. And if you're like me, the shelf space in your bathroom is precious real estate, which is why I am excited to introduce you to a line of beauty products that I just discovered, which is as great at multitasking as you are. It's called Kopari. These are products that moisturize your skin and your hair, and they smell great, but they don't have any sulfates, no silicones, GMOs, or parabens. Instead, Kopari products are made with 100% organic coconut oil. These products are perfect to help you get ready for the summer. They make amazing products like a coconut sheer oil, which is a beautiful light and perfect as a facial moisturizer, coconut balm for intense soothing and smoothing of super dry skin, coconut crush scrub that buffs you beautiful, and a coconut body glow that gives you a natural all-over shimmer. And of course, there's also their original coconut melt, and I've been using these products for the last week, and I have never felt so soft and buttery, to be honest. Now, Kopari searched all around the world for an oil of the highest quality, has a great aroma and a non-gritty texture, and you can apply it from head to toe. So, say aloha to the best skin and hair of your life with Kopari. You can do it by going to KopariBeauty.com/undisclosed to get 20% off your order. Believe me, you want to get these products. Get them for Mother's Day. Get them to get ready for summer. That's Kopari, KopariBeauty.com/undisclosed, and get 20% off your entire order. Enjoy Kopari. I know I am.
Let me just say that there are a few Black police officers that get that and want to do that. But in general, when you look at this issue, it's blue before black. And it is because of how potentially how dangerous the job can be. You know, when you're out there in some of the communities and you're responding to potentially dangerous calls, you do want other people in uniform to be right there with you. And unfortunately, that does exist because we have lost the confidence of the community. If you had the relationships that are needed between police and community, then the community would be there for you when you're going about your business and would make sure that you are protected as you go about your business handling dangerous calls. But unfortunately, most of our police officers don't see that and don't feel that a protection from the community. And there are many reasons why, as we know. So you want that other fellow police officer there backing you up. And when you don't play along with the culture, when you don't play along with the game, just look at Detective Joe Crystal, who was a detective in the city who went about the right way of reporting police abuse. He literally got run out of town by other police officers. He didn't get the protection from the union or anyone else. He ended up leaving the state. Now, other police officers see that. Mm-hmm. Now, are they going to come forward and report wrongdoing by their fellow police officers in uniform? Most are not, because they don't want to be in the same position as Joe Crystal. You know, so it's blue before black. You know, and this is a very, very complex, this police reform thing, it's extremely complex. So whether we're talking about policy, whether we're talking about the proper leadership, whether we're talking about not just laws and policy, but policies internal within the police department. You've got the union, the FOP that's there applying pressure. You got incentivized policing. You've got so many things that come into play, and we still got this race and culture thing going on in and outside of the police department. I got a call from a fellow retired state trooper, a white state trooper who now lives out of state a couple months back. And he was reading some of the stuff that I was posting on Facebook about race and about policing and this, that, and the other, and how police go about this business within the community. And he says to me, he says, Neil, he says, you know, I didn't really get this until I left the state police and started learning, you know, because now I'm outside of the culture and I started learning from reading other things. And he says, how are we going to solve this racial thing between police and community when we can't even solve it within our ranks? So he was talking about the problems that we have with race within our own police departments. As you just heard a little earlier, I think it was Marsha that said, you know, we've got such conflict with black officers trying to establish themselves within the police departments, trying to be respected, trying to get promoted, and to fit in, still trying to fit in, that you sacrifice the people of the community so that you can position yourself within the department to be respected, among which is still predominantly a white male industry.
And seeing when I hear this, it's just, it makes me think about like reform being one of those phony words like diversity. You know, like it sounds good. Like if I get in front of a podium and I say, you know what? I'm about to bring about reform. Everybody claps. And then we don't really see anything happen. Is it a way for one of you guys, Sandra or Marsha, to put this into like some type of historical perspective for us? Because this can't be new. Like the DOJ has went into cities before with the hopes of bringing about reform. I know they were in Cleveland, what, like 20 years ago, and they're back again. So like, you know, maybe some more insight.
Well, you know, I'm not a historian on this subject, but I know what you're saying, and I know that we have had attempts over and over again. You know, one thing that I think communities can think about is to get stakeholders together, because you know, in my experience, at least, especially when you have really critical events like the Freddie Gray case. You know, it seems to be a time when the community leaders need to come together and really bring everyone to the table, you know, church leaders and all the different stakeholders, and talk about the problems and really try to figure out some solutions together. Because, you know, otherwise you get Department of Justice intervention, you get huge lawsuits, and you may have to have those things anyway. You may have riots that break out. But, you know, all these sort of critical points, it seems to me, are times when the business community, the churches, the educators, you know, they need to come to the table with the heads of all the government officials and really come up with some proposals, some big changes that might move the department in a different direction. Because incremental, you know, just sort of giving lip service and saying we're going to have more training, you know, that doesn't really do much. I agree with you all.
And that's all people keep saying is more training, but what does it mean? It's just as bad as us telling our kids to, oh, go to college, you know, go to college and go to college and study what? You know, you just say these things, but we're not putting enough weight behind it. And I don't think we'll ever move forward.
Yeah, well, I think as a college professor, kids go to college. But Dee's point remains very important about the idea of recycling kind of rhetoric and using no context or framing for it. And so people start to feel like there's something wrong with them. How come we haven't solved this problem? But you know, rarely do we have a conversation about what tools we actually have available to us. And so, you know, if we look at it historically, you know, sometimes when I read the conversation about police reform, it could be 1967 or 2017 and the same language and the same ideas, but you could take it to 1917 and 1919 and you look at race riots in major cities like Chicago and people are saying the same things, that the police are not responsive to communities of color, people are being terrorized within their own communities, and then black people who are interested in policing and in justice don't have equal opportunities to do it. And so I think that part of what we have to also understand is that there are very serious consequences, as was stated earlier, for people who are pushing the reform beyond just policy changes to a fundamental question about, you know, the treatment of Black people and race and racism. You know, this conversation makes me think of Captain Ron Johnson, who was all over the television after Ferguson. You remember the Black police officer who was kind of put in charge of command of the situation in Ferguson? And then it was like he was disappeared, right?
Yeah, I remember
there were these moments you see him, like, he's hugging protesters and he's saying things like, you know, this could have been my son. You know, he wears his, you know, pants baggy. And there was this real kind of moment that was really surreal. And then he was disappeared. And part of the analysis of what happened in Ferguson was, well, Ron Johnson was too busy talking to the media and he wasn't doing his job. Well, you know, what does that mean for one Black person to be sacrificed for all of these institutional failures? And so I think that, you know, part of the problem is that it's not just about this question of how do you get access to something, it's the consequences for people who are even pushing the needle a little bit. Because it wasn't like he was, you know, some radical who was saying, you know, we need to dismantle the police state and, you know, everyone needs to take to the street. He was saying, you know, maybe we should treat citizens with a little bit of respect and we shouldn't, you know, come at them like this. And that was too much. And the system could not allow for that. And so I think that, you know, if we look at this problem more from a historical lens, I think we can start to identify in a more efficient way the emptiness of some of the rhetoric and some of the reasons why this can't move forward.
Let me just say something real quick. I think you brought up something extremely important about Captain Johnson. He was the Missouri state trooper that was brought in to help out. And I mean, you're absolutely right. He was disappeared. And a lot of what happened, from my perspective, what I saw and what happened to Captain Ron Johnson was that there were a lot of complaints coming in from mainstream law enforcement about his interacting with the community. I saw it as something really, really good. But unfortunately, this policing culture that we're talking about and these police unions and other folks, some of these folks were I considered friends of mine who were commenting about, for instance, one picture that he had taken with one of his frat brothers and the handshake and complaining about that. And I think that's what happened to Captain Ron Johnson, why he all of a sudden disappeared from the scene. You know, we're trying to get him to come to Baltimore now and during the last week of June to take part in a discussion, a town hall that we're going to have with the National Organization of Retired State Troopers. And that's one of the things that I'd like to be able to hear from him, but I don't know how free he will be able to speak about this because he still wears the uniform. Unfortunately, most of the law enforcement folks who do speak out about these things are retired folks because they have nothing to fear. Their careers won't suddenly be ended or sidetracked or, you know, sidelined. But you said it, you hit the nail right on the head. And when other people, other law enforcement folks see what happened to Captain Johnson when he was trying to do and say the right things about developing, you know, which, you know, hopefully would have resulted in bringing police and community together, this is what happens to them. And so others don't want to step forward while they're still wearing the badge.
That's another thing, which brings up another topic. The episode, we talked a lot about Lieutenant Rice, right? And his history and how Freddie Gray was actually being investigated even though he was dead. But Rice got a chance to kind of hide behind some of the things in his dark past or present even. How does that happen? How does the media miss that? You know, how does it not come up in court? I know he didn't make it to trial, but how does that happen?
You know, one thing that occurred to me as I was reading about his history, Rice's history, is that in some departments, at least, you know, they've been trying to use kind of big data, if you will, right, to use like databases on police officers to keep track of how many arrests they're effectuating, whether there are complaints against them for use of force, how many absences they have, you know, which can indicate that there's some sort of problem, marital issues or whatever is going on with them, health issues. And it's all sort of designed to weed out some of the bad apples that might exist that could really create huge problems for a whole department. I mean, and someone with this kind of history should have been caught and removed a lot, you know, sooner than apparently he was. So it just seems to me like there's a lot of potential there for a better use of data within a department to try to eliminate. I mean, if the department is serious about trying to curtail this kind of aggressive police officer, which they should be.
Yeah, but again, this is why I say the word reform is starting to be one of those phony words, because, you know, this is information that's not put out. He, you know, he gets to be a person who's on file. He's on file as, like, you know, I don't know what to call it, a stalker, a harasser. The person who likes to pop up at police stations and not give his name or his number, but just let you know, I've worked for the Baltimore City Police Department, as if that makes you morally exempt. You wait, you getting drunk and you sitting outside of somebody's house at 2 a.m. You know, let me get drunk, you know, and sit outside somebody's house at 2 a.m. and not giving you my name. You know, I'm just telling you that, you know, I'm a professor at this university on Charles Street. Begins with a John and ends with a Hopkins.
So,
you know, what's, I mean, what are they, you know, with my hoodie on?
So D, and this, it's a shame that Lieutenant Rice never made it to trial, because he's the main one in that whole Freddie Gray incident. When you really think about it and you peel back the onion. Here's a lieutenant who's supposed to be the shift commander. He's the one out there who's supposed to be orchestrating the entire shift for the Western District. But he's on a bike with two other police officers out there looking for people, possessing and selling drugs or doing whatever. That's not what that lieutenant should have been doing that day. Now, let's go back a little bit and talk about his history. First of all, I want to say a lot of people had their own opinions about Ed Norris when he was the commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department. It is one thing he did implement while he was there. He had gone through all of the, or had someone go through all of the internal investigation files to identify those people who had had numerous complaints. Didn't care whether they were sustained or unfounded or whatever. If you had the complaints, here's what we did. We brought all of these people into classroom settings in different groups and basically said, look, this is a situation. All of you are here because you've had numerous complaints filed upon you. This is not a disciplinary action that we're taking right now. What we're saying is, we're watching you. Now, we're going to give you some really good information. We're going to give you some good education. We're going to talk about these things. And during a few days that you're here, we're hoping that this will help you move in the right direction from here. But like we said, we're watching you. If you don't, and you continue to get the complaints, and we continue to look at you, then we'll take, you know, additional action going forward. But basically what I'm saying is, he identified and then started looking at and letting people know that they were being looked at because of the complaints that they were receiving and their prior behavior within the police department and outside of the police department. Unfortunately, that ended. And I think that that would have made a huge difference in this city with the police and the community, and mainly these police officers that do have numerous complaints on them that shouldn't be on the department. And that's one of the things that we fail dramatically at in this country, is identifying those police officers who should not be wearing a uniform and moving outside of the police department. And I end with this. These are the critical things when it comes to a police department and changing the culture. Number one, hiring. Who are you hiring? Where are they from? What type of psychological backgrounds and testing do you do on them? Number two, obviously, is training. And we in this state have some of the best police officer training across the country.
But so that's if we go back to that psychological piece, that shouldn't be a one-time hiring thing, because I feel like officers probably deal with a certain amount of trauma as they progress in their careers.
Right, and I'll come to that at the end of this.
Okay.
So it's the hiring process, then it's the training process, and then when they get to the street, it's that transition piece with the field training instructors. They need to be instructors and coaches bringing these new officers to the street. And then that critical position of sergeant, who is that frontline supervisor, should be continuing the coaching and the training and monitoring and holding people accountable.
Be a leader.
Absolutely.
Not a stalker.
Absolutely. And you got to hold people accountable. And what you were saying is, now here comes the follow-up piece.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have a process for following up on these traumatic incidents that police are involved in, for these complaints that come down the road on them. And that follow-up piece doesn't include psychological evaluations throughout their time on a job, especially for those officers that are working the street. A lot of these officers are dealing with PTSD, they're dealing with other issues, they're dealing with alcoholism, they're dealing with all sorts of issues, and we're not addressing that. And here's the thing, and we know who a lot of these police officers are, but we aren't providing the proper assistance for them, and we're just not doing a very good job of follow-up and holding folks accountable for the things that they do.
There's also, I mean, some real questions about the role that domestic violence and domestic issues have in evaluating the fitness for service. And so, you know, there's been a lot of very good activism that started in the 70s and continued, you know, by feminists who were really concerned about the very complex and specific ways that the domestic violence that originates from individual officers and family violence involving people who are aligned with the police really creates a lot of victims who feel like there is just no exit, you know, when you can't appeal to the system that's supposed to protect you. And so I think it's really important for us to really think about, you know, when we talk about reform, we also need to think about the ways that some of the violence that we see kind of in a public sphere happens within the confines of the home and to the families of officers as well. And those layers of silence, you know, sometimes the silence that exists in police communities aren't just to protect in these misconduct cases. Sometimes they're about officer on officer violence and family violence that can happen within this community.
Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage, and Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. And this has been really convenient for me recently. I'm grading about 100 exams. The law school is moving into a new building. I'm working on an upcoming season of Undisclosed. I'm consulting on a few other cases. And Stamps.com allows me to save that precious time I would otherwise spend going to and from the post office and waiting in line. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter Undisclosed. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again.
So let's, you know, I'm going to throw this question to Marsha and Sandra first, and then if you want to follow up, Neil, you can follow up as well. But you said something very interesting about Rice being on a bike. And then the episode talked about how police officers in Baltimore don't really have partners, right? But I keep hearing all of this talk about how Baltimore City hires so many cops and how we spend so much money on policing. So if we're spending so much money on policing, then who's mishandling those funds? Because if we have this big budget, but yet our cops have cars that break down, our cops don't know how to properly complete paperwork, our cops don't have partners, like, what's going on? Like, what am I missing? Or who's shaving money off the top?
I'm not sure how we're supposed to answer that one, but I think clearly if they have a large budget and they're not a functional department, it's probably, again, I think it goes back to the same concerns that we've been talking about regarding priorities and how the resources are being used. And, you know, from my studies of the war on drugs and everything that I have seen, it seems like too often a lot of the resources are spent, you know, putting people on the streets in communities of color and having them process tons and tons of drug arrests. And, you know, I think that whole model needs to be revamped.
Marcia?
I mean, I think this is about kind of public resources and, you know, the vilification of people who are most vulnerable and need public resources. And so, you know, what can I say? I don't understand how resources are allocated. But what I do understand is that the more and more citizens are aware of the contracts that are given, of the different arrangements that are made with police departments, where they're getting equipment and where they're not getting equipment, you know, where people can call people in a time of crisis and where they can't, the more this information gets out there, I think the more strategic people can get into fighting and to fighting for very specific resources. And so the question is, you know, what are the ways that we can use public dollars to actually make sure that the quality of life has improved instead of just the force of policing? And I think that that has been a long strategy, a civil rights strategy that Black people have deployed to talk about what does it mean when you pay taxes into a system and those tax dollars are used to oppress you? What are some different ways that we can solve that problem by thinking about all the resources people of color contribute instead of always framing the issue as people of color as taking as parasites who need to be disciplined in this way? And I think that shift in consciousness is so critical to get people motivated and to make sure that there's clarity in what we're talking about when we say that the people deserve accountability.
I want to follow the money. Every week I feel like I grow more and more into like a little Black Republican because I'm like, yo, where's, what are you spending my tax dollars on?
Let me put you at ease, D, a little bit. So one of the things I did before I left the Baltimore Police Department in 2004 was I did manage the budget. It was part of, as the chief of human resources, I did have the budget. And there's a little bit of fraud, as we've seen with the seven police officers that were, you know, caught up in a federal sting not too long ago. But that's just minor compared to where money is really being wasted. There is no massive fraud going on within the police department as it relates to money and budget. And believe me, I seriously doubt that. Here's the issue. Most of your money is spent in personnel cost. Okay, then you have your vehicles, your fleet, your equipment, the gasoline that you have to buy for the cars and that sort of thing. Do you know when you're driving a car like in the snow or you're stuck in mud and you're just spinning your wheels and your gas mileage is terrible and, you know, because you're getting no traction? That's what we're seeing here in Baltimore City. The police aren't getting any traction in doing the work of solving violent crime. Why are they not getting traction? Because they don't have the buy-in and partnership with the community. Any police officer or leader that is worth their weight and, you know, that knows their job knows that you can't solve violent crime without the work, the partnership, the buy-in, the information that you need from the community. It just doesn't happen. They're the people that know what's going on. It's the moms, it's the grandparents, it's the corner store owners, it's the young cats playing ball. And, you know, and they're the ones that know who is doing what to who. And when, just like we just finally, looks like we finally solved the murder of the young girl, you know, here in Baltimore City.
Mackenzie Elliott, yeah.
Mackenzie Elliott should have happened much sooner, but we don't have the buy-in of the community. Why? Because of how we go about doing our work. Why? Because we're enforcing these drug laws as willy-nilly, going out here rounding up as many people as we can, incentivize policing so we can get the good evaluations and, you know, the sound bites on the news. We're out there doing our work, this, that, and the other. If we really focused on violent crime, people hurting other people, and not rounding up people the way we have been over the past decade or two in the city, we'd have a lot more buy-in from the community. We'd be much more effective in solving violent crime. And a lot of these dollars that we're currently wasting in public safety can go into community-based programs. One of the things I like what I'm seeing from Kevin Davis is that he's pulling a lot of these so-called plainclothes units, these rollers, these jump-out squads, off of the streets and putting them in uniform. Okay? When Clark came here to the city, he created the Organized Crime Division, about 300 strong in rental cars, plainclothes police officers, three and four deep in these cars, riding around, you know, jumping out, like you said, knocking heads, low-level drug arrests, just scooping up and rounding up a bunch of people. One of the biggest wastes of money and resources within the police department that I've ever seen. the bread and butter, where the real work gets done, where the community relationships can be developed, are those uniformed officers with the proper leadership and guidance in those communities, in those neighborhoods, interacting with the citizens on a daily basis. That's where they should be, and he should continue with that. And in my opinion, get away from all of this low-level drug stuff. If people are carrying guns and they're shooting other people, yeah,
on their Twitter account, them. Posting pictures of a bag of weed and then hashtagging a safer Baltimore. What Thank is you. That? A gun it's, from the 1920s that you got to wind up and plug in to use and then hashtagging a safer Baltimore. I got an idea.
What
we can do to actually save some of that money or put those funds in the right direction is I think that on-duty police officers should double as Uber drivers. So that way they can recoup some of that money for gas and we can be able to afford for them to have partners and things like that. I wanted to talk to Sandra about the war on drugs and just have you give our listeners just an idea of how the system can just throw around a person like Freddie Gray for crimes that are worthless, or how he can get sucked into a system where, you know, he could have been potentially innocent but forced to take a plea deal because there was, like, no other way to go. I know so many people in my own life who, like, were really innocent, but they took the plea because they knew that they was going to get smashed when they went in front of that jury. They knew it was no win.
Yeah, and there's so many facets to this problem. I mean, you know, one of the things that I've been working on for the last 5-6 years is trying to get bail reform because another reason people plead guilty, and sometimes they plead, a lot of times actually, they plead guilty when they're not even guilty of anything because they get stuck in jail because they can't afford the bail money. So, I mean, again, you want to talk about, you know, the war on poor people really is what we're talking about. So many ways we're fighting the bail issue, we're fighting against fines and fees that also end up getting people locked up. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you're stuck in jail because you can't afford to get bail, now all of a sudden you feel really coerced to take that guilty plea. I mean, not to mention, of course, the fact that, as you say, if you go to trial, you might, you know, you're being basically threatened with a much longer sentence. But it's a lot easier to fight charges if you have a decent lawyer and you're out pre-trial. So, you know, there are a lot of different aspects of the problem that need to be addressed. And, you know, you just got to take them on one by one. Here in Houston, I was on the mayor's task transition team for criminal justice. And, you know, we talked a lot about community policing, which we haven't discussed today. But it was, you know, one of the principal recommendations of the president's task force, 21st Century Task Force on Policing, is this concept of community policing. And, you know, again, even just talking about that, right, it requires more resources than other kinds of policing. And as was discussed a lot here, it requires having the right kind of mindset by a police officer, right, to have that kind of trust. But, you know, at the end of the day, the group that I chaired, which, you know, reflected a lot of the communities in our city, really believed that moving more towards a community policing model of having officers in the neighborhood sort of trying to connect with the people that they're supposed to serve in a positive way would be, you know, really a big step forward. And we, you know, we've got to get away. I mean, these kinds of, like you said, roving groups of people in civilian clothes, that's just a disaster. I'm adapting to a violent condition. I'ma probably end up in a jailhouse with them. They gon' have to lock me in a maximum prison before I let them begin come and turn me to a victim. Popping up out the bushes with that chopper spitting. Yeah, I wanted to just continue the conversation on just the war on drugs and how can a person, again, you know, just to further build on the idea of, like, you know, that reality of how Freddie Gray was a white student at Johns Hopkins University with a brick of cocaine taped to his forehead. He can totally enjoy the luxuries of being on a beautiful campus, playing hacky sack, acoustic guitar, going to science class, drinking smoothies and, you know, having a good life. But you give him a nickel bag of weed and throw him in Sandtown Winchester, all of a sudden he's like
another old reference, Nino Brown. Nino Brown in East Baltimore, he deserves to be locked up. Let's just flush that out, because that's just crazy to me.
Well, I think it's this idea about, you know, use value, if you will. There is an assumption that the young man with the cocaine taped to his face, as you like to say, that despite his sale of drugs or use of drugs, that he has value. You know, that drugs are an experimental phase in the life of young people. It's really fun. And then they will, you know, return to their rightful position of power. And I think that one of the things that this also gestures towards is this quote unquote new conversation about addiction, that when it is white, when it is painkillers, when it's opioids, when it's heroin, the kind of compassion that we have seen in the public discourse about drug abuse and drug use that just has not existed ever for communities of color. And so in many ways, it's really difficult to listen to these kind of new progressive reforms about drugs, knowing full well that the reason why they're there is because, you know, when poor white people or white people in general are using drugs, there's a desire to redeem them. And so while we know that marijuana pales in comparison in terms of its impact on people in communities compared to some of these other drugs, at the end of the day, it's not about the type of drugs or drugs itself. It's about our ideas about use value of the individual who's either in possession of those drugs, going to sell those drugs or use those drugs. And so, you know, I think that it is amazing the way that our, you know, prosecutors and our judges, that they can also contribute to this narrative in the choices they make and in the frames that they choose and in the charges that they choose to pursue in reinforcing to the public who is valuable and who's not. And I'm really glad that Sandra brought up bail reform. This week is people are going to Southerners on New Ground for information about Mama's Day bailout. And so in the lead up to Mother's Day, there's a conversation about, you know, skipping the flowers and the brunch and donating to some bail reform actions to get people out of jail so that they can continue with their lives and they can spend some time not only handling their cases, but they don't have to do it from behind bars. So National Black Mamas Bailout Day is one way that people can learn more about the need for bail reform and the larger issues that bail reveals about this disparity about drugs and the war on drugs.
You have to hurry up and participate before Trump finds out and cancels it.
Marcia and Sandra, you got to understand something, though. Young black men are violent. That young black man with that joint, he's just far more violent than that Johns Hopkins student. You know, we've done a very, very good job in this country of connecting drug use and violence to black people. Our young black brothers and sisters are just violent by nature, so we have to go about enforcing these laws a different way. One thing that is very important, and when you look at the data that came out of the Department of Justice investigation here in Baltimore, where over this little four-year period, they looked at the stops of citizens by the Baltimore Police Department, and they were looking at just a little over 300,000 stops, where 3.7% of those stops resulted in a ticket being issued or an arrest being made, where apparently they had probable cause to write that ticket or to make that arrest. And understand that these stops are predominantly about looking for drugs and, you know, why these folks are stopped. But then the Department of Justice says this, you know, that number is what we came up with from looking at the paperwork, of looking at the reports, the arrest reports, the tickets, and so on. But then they decided to look at the CAD system, radio transmissions, and they were able to make another determination that the actual number is probably seven times greater. The actual number of stops is probably seven times greater. It's just that the Baltimore Police Department officers weren't documenting these stops, but the radio transmissions reflect that the stops were being made. So now you're looking at 2.1 million stops during this little over four-year time period. So what does that mean? Well, understand this. The 3.7% of those 300,000 plus stops remains the same of tickets being written or arrests being made. That figure doesn't change. So now you're really looking at 2.1 million stops during that time period, and 0.5%
resulting in a ticket being issued or arrest being made. So what about those 99.5% of those 2.1 million stops? Why are they being made? Who's being stopped? And we know what the answers are. You know, they're young black people in Baltimore City, and it's about the war on drugs. This is about find the drugs, find, you know, make the arrests. And, you know, you stop enough people, you search enough people, you know what? You're going to find the marijuana, you're going to find the heroin, you're going to find the cocaine, you're going to make the arrest. And here we go again, incentivized policing. It's what our public officials and our police leaders communicate to these police officers as what is the priority, what should we be doing, and why should we be doing it. And right now it's still about the war on drugs.
This is a quote from Nixon's John Ehrlich. This is from Nick, domestic policy chief. We knew we couldn't make it to being legal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did.
And the ball's still in play.
Something I want to raise also about war on drugs that I thought was really fascinating when I was doing research for this podcast and doing some more reading is a lot of people in the moment were like, this is a really bad idea. Stop it. And I think that that's important for us to always remember that when we say, well, people didn't know better, or the people who knew didn't tell us that this is what they were up to, and we didn't know. There were some really clear voices out of the law enforcement community, as well as prosecutors and defense attorneys, as well as everyday citizens and activists who said, this war on drugs idea is really bad. And it's going to lock up people unnecessarily, and it's going to hurt our communities. And I think that we always have to remember that there has always been a dissenting voice. The question is, were we prepared to hear it? You know, just like when people say, well, everybody thought slavery was fine and slavery is inevitable and slavery this. It's like, well, no, some people are like, you know what? This is really bad. We really need to stop this institution. And so I think that in many ways, you know, we have to remember that there has been a history of resistance that was trying to tell us, you know, the emperor has no clothes. But the question is the way that we marginalize those voices. And I think that, you know, the things that we are contending now because of the war on drugs, it will take generations to turn that tide. And unless we are really clear about the lesson we're supposed to be learning in this moment, we're going to see it again with another mechanism that has yet to be invented, but could be easily manipulated, especially as we try to figure out ourselves in this political climate.
I was going to say, from where I've been sitting in terms of the bail reform, trying to get bail reform in a state like Texas, where our state government is run by Republicans almost entirely, you know, it kind of reminds me of the comment that was made a little earlier about maybe I'm Republican, because we've had to focus on the areas of common ground, right? So when we talk about bail reform in Texas and trying to get our legislators to move the ball forward, we are talking about the costs to taxpayers. We are talking about evidence-based practices and what's really effective, and public safety. You know, I mean, because again, if you think about our conversation today, we've been saying that they're doing a lot of low-level, nonviolent drug cases that people don't really care about, and what they really do care about are the violent crimes. And, you know, we also mentioned the fact that the opioid crisis is bringing out all this compassion now, right? And this desire for, you know, treating it like a public health crisis and getting rehabilitation programs in place. Well, I think, you know, it's important for us to think about using all of this consensus wherever it's coming from, whether it sort of frustrates us or not, you know, to move the agenda forward in terms of genuine legislative reform on drug crimes and drug sentencing. Because, you know, if you do that, you can really sort of cut the legs out from underneath any policing efforts, you know, because if stuff is just not, it's not a felony anymore, or it's not a crime at all anymore, then a lot of those drug arrests are just going to go away.
How many gonna ride for me? How many gonna die for me? How many gonna ride for me?
Okay, so let me ask you this. So we know there's going to be no real reform as far as dealing with the war on drugs during the current administration, as I believe that Jeff Sessions hates black people more than anything. I think he's like in his office right now, just like stomping on a picture of a black family with like stale toe boots on. So that's not going to happen. But let's just say, you know, let's say we get the prison reform that all these people are advocating for, and we fight and we end the war on drugs like all of these people are fighting for. What are you going to replace it with? Because it seems like to be some type of current theme in this country to suppress black people and black communities. What's the next big thing?
The war on terror.
You know, the
it's
war
already in place.
You know, what are we? I mean, it's always something. If it's not slavery, if it's not Jim Crow, if it's not the prison industrial complex and everything surrounded with it, dealing with policing. And, you know, I read an article. I don't know if we talked about this last week, but I found out if you live in a black neighborhood, car insurance is higher. I said, what the hell? Like, yeah, it's like everything. Like, what's going to replace
it? Just learned that? You just learned about zip codes?
No, I was just breezing.
Area codes and,
yeah, I was just breezing through some Atlantic articles, and I'm like, damn, if you're black, it's like cost more to drive.
Well, there's plenty of things. What about a war on tobacco? War on menthol tobacco products. Understand this, and a lot of people don't know this. There's a push right now to ban menthol tobacco products. Now,
I always thought black people smoke Newports and white people smoke Marlboros. And like the menthol was for like if you're from the hood.
Well, think about this.
And if you're earthy, white or black, if you're like an earthy type vegan, you roll your own cigarettes.
One of my students just submitted a very good paper about the targeting of menthol cigarettes to black communities. I mean, this is like from the 40s that there was this kind of concerted effort to bring this type of cigarette. And it's amazing how enduring it is, right? Like, despite all of the public health stuff about smoking, blah, 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 the way that this kind of consumer loyalty was built and allowed, you know, for the profiting of. And so I think it's, you know, the war on tobacco is a really interesting way to think about this, because even things as that seem so, you know, just like, oh, it's just smoking. It's like even there you see a targeted racial project.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And we all know, we all understand. Look, we don't want anyone smoking tobacco. We know it kills about, you know, 400,000 people a year in this country. But here's the thing.
Why not I just ban it? Okay.
So of the tobacco products that we use in the black community, 78% of those tobacco products are menthol related. So what happens when you ban menthol tobacco products? Now, you don't have to make it illegal for someone to be smoking a menthol or possessing a menthol cigarette. But what happens to the transportation, the trafficking of now banned menthol tobacco cigarettes? You just create an opportunity for someone to drive two states over. You know, if my state now has a ban, to drive two states over, one state over, load up, bring them back into the hood.
Get that menthol.
And what, you think the police are going to allow that to happen? No, because the politicians aren't going to allow that to happen, because these aren't going to be taxed. You know, it's going to be circumventing a ban that they put in place. So the police are going to be pressured to find out who's bringing them in. And the way that we do that, we find out who's smoking them. Where are you getting them from? You know, and then we have another way, a method of criminalizing the black community as relates to tobacco. You know, and that's just the beginning of it. But this is what we're seeing. San Francisco is right in the process of passing this type of ban.
Wow.
And then look for Oakland. And we better get our eyes on this as quickly as possible before it balloons to a place where it is now out of control and we're dealing with this another mechanism for criminalizing the black community. Don't get me wrong. The way that you deal with problematic tobacco use within our communities is through education and treatment. That's how you deal with it, not our criminal justice system.
I feel bad. I'm going to blame Trump, but I started smoking again because of the current administration. The news makes me depressed, and then I twitch and I started smoking. And full disclaimer, I have to smoke cigarettes with menthol only because I'm black and grew up around all black people in black schools and black neighborhoods. So I'm biologically programmed. That's my preference.
Right.
Like, so I feel like I will be betraying my culture. If you caught me with American spirits, I would be betraying my culture. Like, I would be, you know, the people who came before me will be twirling in their graves, and I'm just not going to do that to them. Sorry. So we've been talking, you know, a little humor for the dark situations, but I just want to give, you know, Sandra and Marsha and Neil just some opportunities to reflect on some of the things we talked about or to put in anything that we missed, because again, we want to inform our listeners and give them as much as possible so that they can know how to move forward when thinking about the war on drugs or when thinking about you know, what we can do or what needs to be done, or just giving the young thinkers and the old ones too, just some insight on moving forward. If we can start with you, Sandra, and then go to Neil and then Marsha.
Sure. So I can give an example from the bail reform efforts that we've been doing here in Texas. You know, they've involved everyone because, you know, when I was told in 2011, you can't change the bail laws in this state because the bail bond industry is so powerful. But, you know, we've been active with everyone from the business community, the churches, all the different groups have really sort of come together and brought media attention to the issue. Civil rights groups have brought lawsuits. We just got a huge judgment here in Houston on Friday, where a federal judge declared the Harris County's bail system to be unconstitutional. It's a major victory for us, and the Texas Senate today is considering some legislation. But it has really taken a lot of discussion and trying to find consensus, you know, between so many different kinds of groups who are affected by this, and making people understand what the issues are, and just, you know, sort of a relentless effort forward in terms of building communities around the issue, public education around the issues, and really exploring what are the best reforms that can be made. And it's a never-ending fight, right, on a lot of different fronts, but you can take one piece of it and try to fix it by bringing everyone to the table. And I think there is hope for the future, but it takes everyone to get involved.
Yeah. So, Sandra, I just want to say that I just came back from Texas, and so that people, you know, Texas has a bad rap when it comes to criminal justice, and there's a lot of good stuff going on in Texas. And I met with a lot of police chiefs while I was down there. I know Ed Gonzalez there in Harris County, so I think you have a really good sheriff down there. You have also a good prosecutor down there now. And
that's right.
Yeah, you do. And you know, one of the things that we're trying to do with our organization, let me get a plug in for the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, is to bring these law enforcement leaders together, you know, who are thinking about these solution-oriented reforms, that whether it's bail reform, you know, whether it's law enforcement assisted diversion, you know, pre-arrest diversion, which I think is extremely important. Not so much these drug courts, but let's not arrest people in the first place, get them into treatment, get them the help that they need. And so we're trying to build this coalition of law enforcement leaders, you know, to move these solution oriented reforms forward. And we talk about this a lot, these many different ways we can do this on our website. And one of the things I like to do with you, Sandra, is to hopefully work with you on some of the things that we're doing in Texas as well. But I think that I'll wrap my piece up with this. We talked about a lot in this particular segment, and we always talk about police reforms. We talk about different ways to do things. We talk about building relationships between the police and community. You know, if we were to get law enforcement in general, when I say law enforcement, I'm talking about cops, I'm talking about prosecutors, I'm also talking about judges as well and others. If we can get them on board with moving in the right direction, and don't focus so much on the federal level right now, but let's focus on the individual states. That's where the work really gets done, and that's where we have some really good positive change take place. If we can do that, then I think we can move a lot of these issues quickly. And I reflect back on how I made this transition, because I was once one of these folks wearing a uniform and a badge and who was like, yeah, these folks are criminals. You know, most of my career was about drug enforcement and criminal investigation. I locked up a lot of people for minor drug violations all the way up to some serious drug violations. But I made the change. And how did I make that change?
You're like one of those guys that went to church or something.
Yeah. I like church, by the way.
Right.
But it was education, man, not training. Mm-hmm. It was education. Mm-hmm. It was about history. It was about the history of our drug laws. It was about, Dee, what you talked about, knowing about the Nixon tapes and John Ehrlichman and what was the real reason for the war on drugs. It ain't about drug abuse, folks. It's about social control and economics. Mm-hmm. You know, if we were to teach our law enforcement folks, educate them in these areas, and get them to see and understand things differently, I think we can move these issues along rather quickly. And we're going to need them on board, I think, to do it and to do it effectively. So that's where I'd like to leave it. However we can do this, let's educate some of these folks in the law enforcement community to be part of this solution-oriented reform, not just reform.
Thank you. And Marcia?
I would make a big plug for thinking about if we want a real reform and change in the system, then it has to be tied to an economic platform. I think you said, you made this point, Dee, you know, if we were to get everybody out of the prisons and we would stop the shenanigans of arresting people for these low-level offenses and really create reform, there has to be an economic justice platform. People need jobs, they need strong communities, and they need opportunities to take care of their own needs. And that's my second plug, is that if we're serious also about reforming policing, then we have to imagine a model where people can get their needs met outside of the structure of police. So when a person is having a mental health crisis, when there's conflict in a home between domestic partners or with children, we need other resources besides the police as the first responders, because part of what we are contending with is situations where police are untrained, uninformed, and lack the knowledge and the skill set to intervene in these situations, and they escalate and people end up dead or severely injured. And so when we start thinking about this reform, we have to think about what we're going to do on the local level in our communities. And then we have to really dream big about a world in which communities can meet their own needs.
Exactly. Beautiful. And one thing I would just like to add to that is when you think about Freddie Gray, don't think about some guy in West Baltimore that you would never meet. Think about your brother or your friend or even your own son, and understand that it happened to him. So it could potentially happen to one of your family members as well, unless we fight for the change and the reforms that we all deserve. One of the reasons why I love working with the brilliant people that come through these doors and who participate in these podcasts is that we are giving insight, and we also open to talk to people who have different points of views. So if you feel differently and you work in law enforcement, or, you know, you're like a judge, or you're even one of these cops who, you know, ride around in these communities, and you have a way, you know, if you think we're missing something, then we welcome you to come on and talk about it, because I think everyone will grow from it. Today, I was very, very lucky and blessed to be joined by my co-hosts, Marcia Chatlin, Major Neil Franklin, and Sandra Thompson. Thank you guys for coming on. Yeah. So, where can people find you at?
So you can find me, Neil Franklin. I'm really easy to find. It's Neil, N-E-I-L-L, two L's, Franklin, F-R-A-N-K-L-I-N. You can find me at Neil Franklin on Twitter, or you can find me on Facebook the same way. Neil, again, N-E-I-L-L with two L's. And also through our organization, the lawenforcementaction.org, lawenforcementaction.org.
And Marcia, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Dr. D-R. M-C-H-A-T-E-L-A-I-N at Dr. M. Chatlin. And you can find me on the internet at MarciaChatlin.com.
You can find me on any form of social media at D. Watkins World. I have a Facebook, but I don't really use it as much, but you can, there's information there too. And remember, fans, you can participate in the social media discussion with the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda with the hashtag UD addendum. Where's your questions at? We want to know what you're thinking about. And follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle at undisclosed POD. Thank you, and have a blessed day.
The undisclosed addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks to Ryan and Ernesto for continuing to support us. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum, along with super producer Methil Telhan. To our fans, thank you for supporting our sponsors. Great sponsorship makes for great podcasts. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music. The embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist who lends his sounds to our show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Undisclosed Pod. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Until then.